And now we have just enough time to squeeze in yet one last interview. I guess we need a drum roll for this. We're talking with the musicologist, prominent musicologist, I should say, Mark Clegg. And I'm Brad Cresswell here with Mary Claire Murphy. Mark, we've got a little time, but you brought in these remarkable recordings. And the first one is a Star Spangled Banner. I can't wait to hear this. Why don't you set it up for us and we'll play that.
Yeah, so this is a recording I made with students here at the University of Michigan. It sort of started off my research into the history of the nation's anthem. And I had been teaching a class on American music, and so we found the very first sheet music publication of the Star Spangled Banner. It's from just a couple months after the song was written. This is probably November of 1814, and it reflects the way the Star Spangled Banner would have been heard in Francis Scott Key's own day. So listen to the tempo, listen to the sort of rolling affect, and listen to which performing forces are involved.
Okay, well, let's hear that recording, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about other stuff that's going on here on FM 91 on the road. You know, Mark, that sounds a lot more like a drinking song to me than what we normally think of.
It is certainly a party song. I mean, one of the things that's changed, I mean, today you hear like Whitney Houston's recording, which is in 4/4 time. It's much slower, much more reverent. Right. This is a party song. I mean, we had just beaten the British. We didn't expect to beat the British. So this is a time of celebration. So the exuberance, the energy, the sort of rolling triple meter, you don't have all the martial dotted rhythms that we associate with today, like that opening triadic descent, oh, say. Here it's just, oh, say, can you see? So it really rolls along. But that was really, it's a different social function because it's a song of celebration rather than a song that's a sacred hymn to the nation as in today. Because the Civil War changed the song. The sacrifice of American life to preserve the Union really changes the whole feeling and sort of emotional power of the song.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Now, you as a musicologist, you've also done a lot of work on covering and exploring many different facets of musical history. Tell us about what's going on with the Gershwin Project, because this is something that we talked about a little bit last time, but last time was pre-pandemic. It was a few years ago in 2019. What have you done? What is going on with the project since that time?
Well, the most exciting thing for me is that we finally have the very first editions coming out in book form of the Gershwin Critical Edition. It's been available to orchestras and performing ensembles for years now, but we now have it available for the general public. So the first volume we've published is Rhapsody in Blue, the 1924 Jazz Orchestra.
Yeah.
But the whole thing has just expanded and exploded. We have started to work on George and Iris shows, so we're working on Of the I Sing, and we'll hopefully do a test performance here on campus in not too long. But just a lot of exciting developments and discoveries. I mean, I knew that this was a, you know, for the cultural heritage of America, the George and Ira Gershwin release, you know, the Great American Songbook, it's sort of the sound of America in so many ways, what we're used to from Tin Pan Alley to Broadway. But I didn't expect to discover so many things. And really getting into history is so fascinating because when you dig into the details, you're always surprised by new things, whether it's the correct pitches of the taxi horns or, you know, lost manuscripts and performance materials. It's really a thrill. One of the things we have here at the university is actually George Gershwin's own piano. It was in his apartment in New York, Riverside Drive. And we've had some students working on, you know, making recordings and doing a lot of interesting projects to sort of bring like Heifetz's arrangements for violin, you know, and make recordings with George's piano accompanying them. So it's really pretty fantastic.
Now, is that the recording that you brought in with the Heifetz arrangement
is,
of the three
so
preludes?
This is one of the three preludes. It's one of our violin students, a recent graduate, Hiram Elizabeth Lee. And this is her rendition of the third prelude. And the piano you'll hear is actually George Gershwin's own Steinway piano chosen for him that was restored lovingly by our piano department.
All right, let's hear it here on FM 91. On the road. That was George Gershwin's piano. And that arrangement by Yasha Heifetz, the third of the three preludes, this was performed by the violinist Hiram Elizabeth Lee, Alex Brown at the piano. And that was one of the recordings brought in by our final guest for FM 91 On the Road. That is musicologist Mark Clegg. Mark, before we have to go, I want to hear the story quickly again for folks who don't know of the taxi horns in the Gershwin piece.
So An American in Paris, is a piece that is basically George's own reflections, a diary, if you will, of his visit to Paris in 1928. And one of the exciting things in Paris was the automobile. The taxis rolling around the Place de Concorde and, you know, all the automobile shops. And Gershwin actually went into the shops and he bought 20 different taxi horns. So these are the old kind, you know, like the brass curly cues with the rubber bulbs at the end, and they go honk, honk, honk. And but, you know, they were not standardized equipment. They were all custom made, and they all made a slightly different sound, different timbres, but also different pitches. So he brings them back to his hotel room. He tries out the 20 of them. He picks three of them that make very, or actually four, that make very specific pitches. And then he writes them into his tone poem, Celebration of Life in Paris. But there is no, surprisingly, standard taxi horn notation. Mozart never wrote for taxi horns. Beethoven didn't write for taxi horns. So you didn't know how to do it. So what he did is he wrote it as a single line, like, you know, a snare drum or a triangle. He just puts those two eighth notes and quarter note, donk, 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 honk, honk, honk. And then to label them, he puts A, B, C, and D to represent the first four taxi horns. George, you know, to make a long story short, when George passes away, the taxi horns are lost. You know, everybody assumes that those refer to concert pitches, concert A, concert B, concert C, concert D. So they were actually translated into the score as if written for a piano, so with the note heads A, B, C, and D. When I went back to look at George's actual manuscript, I realized he should have just called them 1, 2, 3, and 4, because the pitches are A flat, B flat, high D, and low A. It gives a much more dynamic, much more sort of, you know, cacophonous, dissonant, but also funny. That lowest note is really hilarious to hear, that low A, and audiences often laugh. But, you know, for some reason, taxi horns do not go around playing an A minor scale. Instead, it's a much more random set of pitches.
I'm just going to pull up a little music there. We're going to have to call it a day as far as talking here and on the radio. Mark Clegg, I want to thank you so much for spending a little time with us and telling us about this fascinating story and the fascinating stories that I'm sure that we could spend an entire afternoon with you talking about it. But we're grateful for the time we have.
Thanks so much.